You're listening to the Monetary Blog from the FOMC Insight Engine. This is the test. The roadmap maps four pillars and depends on five. The fifth is the one the doctrine does not name. The roadmap is specific. The coordination published it yesterday. Four seats, five failure points, two 24-month endpoints, a commitment to take the balance sheet down a couple trillion dollars over time, in concert with the Treasury Secretary, delivering materially lower interest rates. The instruments the chair holds under his own doctrine reach the short end of the curve by fiat and the asset side of the balance sheet by decree. The outcomes the commitment promises depend on a fifth instrument, controlled from a seat the axis does not hold. A Treasury composition coordination history records as time-limited, a regulatory reform process on a clock slower than the asset side runoff, and a foreign absorber the archive records as pro-cyclical. These are testable claims. The sequence. The governing contradiction is structural, not rhetorical. The roadmap's rate cut commitment and balance sheet target are coherent if and only if a specific sequence holds. The Federal Reserve reduces its balance sheet through passive runoff and active MBS sales, transferring duration to private markets. The Treasury shortens issuance composition, absorbing some of that duration on the supply side. Foreign central banks absorb more, either through swap line coordination or through continued accumulation. The reserve demand floor, the level of bank reserves below which the overnight funding market stops functioning, does not bind before Michelle Bowman's regulatory reforms change its location. Rate cuts arrive alongside the reduction because the balance sheet is doing the tightening the federal funds rate would otherwise have to do. The long end falls because issuance composition has absorbed the duration the Fed sheds. Each piece of the sequence depends on timing. Each piece's timing depends on the other pieces. The roadmap is a choreography of conditional dependencies. Whether the sequence can complete is the question the archive can answer. The Federal Reserve has conducted balance sheet reduction once before at comparable scale, the 2017 to 2019 normalization. It has coordinated with Treasury on issuance composition during Operation Twist in 1961 and again in 2011. It has attempted to change bank liquidity behavior through administrative reform multiple times across multiple decades. It has deployed swap lines as crisis instruments and wound them down as conditions normalized. It has observed foreign official behavior through multiple cycles of dollar strength and weakness. Each component of the current roadmap has an archive entry. The question is not whether the components exist. The question is whether the sequence has ever held together at the scale this program requires. The test proceeds by running each piece of the sequence against its archive analog and following the logical pressure the results create. Where a piece holds, the sequence survives, and the next piece comes into focus. Where a piece breaks, the sequence forces the argument onto new ground, and the next piece is tested under tighter constraints. The archive does not take sides on whether the program should proceed. It reports what it records. The reader follows the sequence to its endpoint. The floor. The first piece of the sequence is passive runoff. When a treasury matures, the Federal Reserve declines to reinvest. Treasury pays the Fed from its general account. Fed holdings fall by the matured amount. Treasury auctions new debt to rebuild the account. Primary dealers pay with reserves. The balance sheet reduction lands on the asset side at Fed Treasury holdings and on the liability side at bank reserves in equal amounts. The mechanism is clean. The mechanism has a floor, a level of bank reserves below which the overnight funding market stops functioning, and the Federal Reserve's record of projecting that floor is the archive entry most directly relevant to whether the current program can execute at the scale its commitment requires.
The 2017-2019 balance sheet normalization is the case. Staff baseline projections of the reserve floor moved from $100 billion in March 2017 to $500 billion in November 2018 to $1 trillion in December 2018. The actual floor bound at approximately $1.45 trillion on September 17, 2019. The overnight repo rate spiked from roughly 2.2% to over 5% in a single session, forcing emergency Federal Reserve intervention. The normalization program was terminated under market pressure it did not anticipate and could not absorb. Four named officials warned between December 2018 and May 2019, and all four were overruled. From the Lael Brainard, the process of probing for the kink between the flat and steep parts of the demand curve is likely to be fraught. It will necessarily entail spikes in funds rate volatility. From the Raphael Bostic, given that there is uncertainty about the precise level of demand for reserves, I am in favor of slowing the rundown of the balance sheet in such a way that does not risk our shrinking the balance sheet beyond a threshold level that would move us into a limited reserves regime. From the Patrick Harker, a key issue is that we only have estimates of the demand for reserves, and we certainly don't have the luxury of a tensile test. Breaking points in engineering and economics are very different animals. We should therefore approach the efficient and effective level of reserves with caution. From the Randall Quarles, it's not as though there's a clear and precise number that comes from reaching the steep part of the demand curve. The four warnings share a structure. The reserve demand curve is uncertain at its kink. Probing toward the kink carries volatility costs the models cannot price. The floor's location is not knowable in advance through the measurement apparatus the institution deploys. After the event, the limitation became visible in a different form. The Senior Financial Officer Survey, the primary analytical instrument for estimating bank reserve demand, surveyed banks, but not the leveraged traders and non-bank participants whose treasury repo positions had grown sharply over 2018-2019 and whose September 17th funding pressure was not predictable from any data the staff routinely collected. The model's failure was not an error in calibration. It was a gap in the instrument. In June 2019, 3 months before the repo spike, Federal Reserve operations staff, Nate Werfel, Laura Lipscomb, and Steve Spurry, proposed a standing repo facility that could have provided the backstop the 2017-2019 program lacked. The committee discussed it and declined to implement it. The September 17th stress forced implementation. The standing repo facility that exists today is the post hoc version of an instrument the institution considered and rejected during the program it might have saved. After the event, staff acknowledged that aggregate estimates of reserve demand from the Senior Financial Officer Survey do not provide information about the additional amount of reserves that may be needed to overcome distributional frictions and thus may be needed to ensure ample supply. And that during the crisis week, both demand for and supply of overnight funding appeared to be relatively inelastic, that is, unresponsive to price signals. The framework for reserve adequacy shifted from a static floor model to a dynamic distributional model as a direct consequence of the event. The institution's own post-mortem rewrote the analytical apparatus the forecast had relied on.
The current program targets further reduction than Powell ever attempted. At current caps, $50 billion per month on treasuries, continued MBS runoff, the combined passive ceiling over 24 months is approximately $1.6 trillion, or 80% of the stated target. Delivering the remaining 20% requires either faster caps, active MBS sales, or a lower reserve floor. Faster caps and active sales accelerate the approach to the floor. A lower floor depends on the regulatory reforms to the liquidity coverage ratio and the discount window that Vice Chair for Supervision, Michelle Bowman, has been rolling out since her confirmation. The question of whether passive runoff reaches the target reduces to a question of whether the floor moves in time. The archive's answer on the 2017-2019 case is that the floor did not move, that the institution did not see the floor coming, and that the instrument that could have provided a backstop was rejected during the program and implemented only under market pressure. The program's first piece does not fail in the archive. The floor is where it stops.
The reform. The floor moves if banks hold fewer reserves. Banks hold fewer reserves if the liquidity coverage ratio, the discount window stigma, and the supervisory tolerance that together govern how banks manage liquidity change in a direction that lets banks operate with thinner, high-quality liquid asset buffers. Bowman's seat is where that change would originate. The coordination identified this as the fifth instrument, the one the axis does not hold, and identified the fourth and fifth failure points as the specific uncertainties. Whether Bowman's reforms produce the behavioral change their rule changes presume, and whether the floor binds before the reforms finalize. The test asks what the archive records about reforms of this kind. The archive records Bowman's own 2024 analysis before it records her 2026 prescription. At the Committee on Capital Markets Regulation Roundtable on April 3, 2024, Bowman stated the institutional position. From the Michelle Bowman. The Federal Reserve cannot entirely eliminate discount window borrowing stigma through regulatory fiat. The 2024 analysis continued. The market will continue to take signal from a bank's external activities in liquidity markets and try to extrapolate whether a bank is using the discount window and draw a negative inference from this borrowing. Stigma, in Bowman's 2024 formulation, is not a policy design problem. It is a rational calculation on the demand side. Bank treasurers know that borrowing at the window carries reputational costs no regulator can offset. The cost is imposed by counterparties and creditors, not by the Federal Reserve. Administrative reform of the supply side, easier terms, broader eligibility, less onerous documentation, cannot reform the demand dynamic. The five-decade archive behind the 2024 analysis is consistent. The 1984 FDICIA era reforms did not change discount window utilization in a sustained way. The 2003 primary credit redesign, which created above-market pricing to detach the window from emergency connotations, did not eliminate stigma. William Dudley, at the December 6, 2007 FOMC conference call, stated the finding directly. From the William Dudley. Stigma is very stable. If you start with stigma, you are probably going to have persistent stigma. The term auction facility, introduced in December 2007 as a workaround to a broken discount window, was wound down by 2010. Elizabeth Duke, speaking as governor on February 18, 2010, summarized the institutional lesson in two sentences from her Hampton Roads speech. The dilemma facing the Fed is that when discount window borrowing is most needed to keep credit flowing, it is most stigmatized. And later, because banks were very reluctant to use the window, that key tool was broken. The Bank Term Funding Program of 2023, created in response to the Silicon Valley Bank failure, was a direct repeat, a workaround deployed when the standing tool could not function, wound down when conditions normalized. Each subsequent crisis produced a new facility on the same institutional premise. Each facility was temporary.
The 1936-37 reserve requirement episode sits at the outer edge of the pattern. The Federal Reserve doubled reserve requirements in three steps between August 1936 and May 1937 to drain what it saw as excess reserves. Banks responded by rebuilding buffers well above the new requirement. The contraction that followed, the 1937-1938 recession, sometimes called the Roosevelt recession, was deep enough that the Fed's reserve requirement action remains the leading candidate for its proximate cause. The pattern was that banks respond to reserve level changes through buffer adjustments that regulators cannot fully anticipate. Bowman's 2024 argument is that pattern pushed back seven decades. Bowman's 2026 position reverses.
In her March 3, 2026 remarks at the same CCMR venue where she had articulated the 2024 analysis, Bowman described hoarding as a regulatory problem with a regulatory solution. From the Michelle Bowman, banks create additional buffers by hoarding high-quality liquid assets rather than lending. This liquidity hoarding reduces credit availability to the economy. In addition, by increasing the demand for reserves, it also requires the Fed to maintain a larger balance sheet to meet that demand. The 2026 diagnosis identifies the mechanism correctly. Hoarding raises reserve demand. Higher reserve demand raises the floor. The larger balance sheet follows. The chain is real. The question is whether the prescription Bowman's 2026 reforms deploy, LCR recalibration, discount window modernization, supervisory tolerance changes, can reverse the chain on a timeline the balance sheet reduction can match. The archive's answer is that reforms of this kind have been attempted 5 times and delivered behavioral change in none. Each attempt was either wound down, forced a workaround, or produced responses regulators did not anticipate. The 2024 Bowman was synthesizing that record. The 2026 Bowman is proposing to be the first exception. The Administrative Procedure Act sets the floor moving clock. The liquidity coverage ratio recalibration, if it follows the pattern of the 2023 Basel III endgame proposal, will take between 12 and 30 months from notice of proposed rulemaking to final rule effective date. The behavioral change test, whether banks actually reduce buffers when the rules let them, can begin only after the rule takes effect and then requires 6 to 12 months of H8 bank data to establish a trend. The earliest credible read on whether the 2026 reforms work arrives in 2028. The balance sheet reductions approach to the $2.2 trillion reserve floor at current runoff and potential active sale rates arrives around month 15 of the program, in 2027, well before the behavioral test can return its verdict. The program must execute as if the reforms will work. The evidence that would support or refute that assumption is structurally unavailable within the execution window. The coordination. If the balance sheet reduction cannot deliver the long-end rate outcome by itself, if the floor stops the reduction at 80% of the target and the behavioral test cannot return in time, the rate cut commitment depends on Treasury. Warsh's own framing on Fox Business acknowledged this. Take down that balance sheet a couple $1 trillion over time in concert with the Treasury Secretary, that's a big rate cut that could come. Let Secretary Bessent handle the fiscal accounts, and materially lower interest rates follow. The formulation is clean. Treasury shortens issuance composition, absorbs the duration the Fed sheds, delivers the long end the chair cannot deliver alone. This is the most institutionally reasonable element of the program. Coordination between Treasury and the Federal Reserve on financing a large transition is not an exotic proposal. It is what happens when governments face fiscal monetary transitions at scale. The archive records the Federal Reserve's current chair, then a governor, stating the institutional position on this claim in September 2014. From the Jerome Powell, my starting point would be that the Federal Open Market Committee did what it thought was appropriate ex ante to return the economy to full employment and stable prices, taking Treasury decisions concerning debt management as exogenous.
Treasury debt management is exogenous to the Federal Open Market Committee's decision frame. The formulation is careful. It does not say Treasury is irrelevant. It does not say coordination is impossible. It says the FOMC's analytical posture is to treat Treasury composition as an input that is set elsewhere. The roadmap proposes the opposite. The Treasury composition operates as a coordinated instrument within the program. Powell's 2014 statement establishes the institutional position the roadmap reverses. The 2011 maturity extension program is the case most directly relevant. Operation Twist's second deployment shortened the Fed's portfolio on the asset side and was received by the market with ambivalence.
Subsequent Federal Reserve research on the program's effectiveness, including board staff analyses prepared during the 2019 long-run SOMA composition deliberations, concluded that the quantitative effects of maturity extension on term premiums were significantly smaller than the LSAPs that preceded it, and that the program's transmission was partially offset by private market responses and by Treasury issuance decisions running in the opposite direction. James Hamilton's contemporaneous analysis, cited subsequently in Richmond Fed research, recorded the asymmetry. The 1961 Treasury reinforced the Fed's portfolio shortening. The 2011 Treasury was lengthening its issuance, even as the Fed shortened its portfolio. The retrospective inside the Federal Reserve's own deliberations was direct. Patrick Harker, at the April 30, 2019 FOMC discussion of long-run portfolio composition, put the assessment in the record. LSAPs are always an alternative, and indeed may have a bigger bang for the buck than maturity extension programs. Two findings now sit in the record. The institutional posture treats Treasury as exogenous. The retrospective on the 2011 maturity extension concluded that it was a less powerful instrument than the LSAPs that preceded it, and that its transmission was partially offset by Treasury issuance running in the opposite direction. The current program proposes a maturity extension at larger scale, for a longer duration, and, unlike the 2011 program, explicitly relies on Treasury moving in the same direction as the Fed. The reader can follow the direction the program moves from here. If the institutional posture and the institutional retrospective both push against the coordination this program requires, the Reserve Bank presidents who will vote on the program are the next constraint. Reserve Bank presidents who participated in the 2011 deliberations dissented from the program and elaborated their concerns publicly in the days surrounding the vote. Three of them, Fisher of Dallas, Plosser of Philadelphia, and Coca-Lakota of Minneapolis, voted against the September 21, 2011 decision. Plosser, in a Financial Times interview a week before the meeting, articulated the parameter concern directly. Charles Plosser. The Treasury could accomplish the same thing by just issuing a bunch of short-term debt and purchasing long-term debt. And, indeed, in an Operation Twist-type activity, the Treasury could actually undo it by taking advantage and offering a lot more long-term debt. The 2011 dissenters identified two distinct concerns: the institutional credibility cost of the action and the parameter dependency that would determine its results. Plosser, at Villanova School of Business on September 29, 2011, named the credibility concern. The actions of August and September would undermine the Fed's credibility by creating the impression that it could deliver outcomes it could not. Fisher's own September 27, 2011 Dallas Assembly speech named the parameter concern from the other direction: that monetary accommodation could not solve a problem whose source lay in fiscal and regulatory choices the central bank did not control. The institution's own Reserve Bank presidents, in the public record around the 2011 vote, named both directions of the constraint. Treasury choices could undo the Fed's program, Plosser, and the program's effectiveness depended on fiscal cooperation the Fed could not compel, Fisher.
The parameter gap is the next constraint. If the 2011 Reserve Bank presidents were right that Treasury's choices determined the program's results, the current program's rate cut commitment depends on what Treasury will in fact do. That question surfaces in the current program's own analytical lineage through a 2019 formulation by a sitting Reserve Bank president. From the Neil Kashkari, "I think it's almost obvious that the Treasury would respond and shorten the maturity of their security issuance in response to a long-term strategy of us having a short portfolio." Almost obvious is the rhetorical move. The question the formulation does not answer is whether the Treasury's response, should it come, compounds the duration pressure on private markets or partially offsets it. Treasury's debt management is driven by cost minimization across the yield curve, by debt service volatility management,
by Treasury Borrowing Advisory Committee recommendations, and by market absorption capacity. The correlation Kashkari treats as obvious is an assumption about Treasury's behavioral response function that the archive does not confirm. Treasury has shortened issuance in periods when the Fed was extending, 2020 to 2021, and in periods when the Fed was neutral. Treasury's composition decisions are responsive to a set of factors that includes the Fed's portfolio, but is not dominated by it. Whether Fed short portfolio plus Treasury short issuance compound or partially offset depends on parameters the roadmap does not specify. If Treasury issuance is growing because of fiscal deficit, Treasury short bias means the growth of duration supply is slower than it would otherwise be, even while the Fed is shedding. Whether the net flow is compound or offsetting depends on specific deficit trajectories, Fed runoff caps, and private absorber capacity. The archive does not resolve the parameter question. The roadmap does not set the parameters. The instrument delivers its stated effect if the parameters cooperate and produces a different effect if they do not. The historical base rate on Treasury-Fed coordination at this operational proximity is specific. The 1951 Accord, which the Druckenmiller framing invokes as structural precedent, established Fed independence by ending Treasury-directed yield pegging, not by sustaining close coordination. Martin spent the rest of his chairmanship building institutional distance from Treasury, and the operational transition in the first 2 years was chaotic by the archive's own record. Operation Twist in 1961 worked for approximately 4 years before coordination frayed. Operation Twist in 2011 was received, by the Federal Reserve's own chair in retrospect, as partially self-defeating. The Volcker-Reagan coordination of the early 1980s broke under fiscal expansion the Federal Reserve could not accommodate. Coordination of this kind has historically held for 2 to 4 years and has ended when fiscal and monetary interests diverged. The current program requires sustained coordination through a 24-month execution window and into a third year of continued runoff against a now lower floor. The window is inside the historical base rate, but near the edge. The institutional record contains both directions. Volcker, in 1982, framed exchange rate movements as reinforcing the domestic objective of stability. Nathan Sheets, as director of the Division of International Finance, in 2009, described swap line coordination as expanding the Federal Reserve's capacity to prevent foreign funding pressures from spilling into domestic markets. The 2008 to 2010 swap line deployment is a good process, good outcome case by the institution's own post-mortem. The Federal Reserve has coordinated with Treasury during multiple episodes, and some of the coordination worked. What the archive does not contain is sustained coordination of the scope and duration this program requires, proceeding without encountering the credibility concern Plosser named, the parameter gap the 2011 dissenters identified, and the retrospective finding Powell later recorded. Coordination can be done. The roadmap's version of coordination, larger, longer, more ambitious in its rate commitment, has no clean archive precedent.
The variable. The balance sheet reduction transfers roughly $2 trillion of duration from the Federal Reserve's portfolio to private markets over 24 months. Treasury issuance composition, if it shortens, absorbs some of that duration on the supply side. Domestic investors absorb some of it at prevailing yields. The remainder depends on foreign central banks and foreign private holders. The $3.8 trillion of treasuries, the FT piece on the dollar swap puzzle documented outside the Fed. The roadmap's arithmetic treats this foreign absorption as stable. The archive records it as something else. From the William Dudley, we've had very strong demand for treasury securities from us through the LSAP program, and very strong demand for treasury securities from oil-producing countries in terms of their accumulation of foreign exchange reserves. And we're sort of losing both of those. Dudley named the structural condition at the moment the previous reduction cycle was being contemplated. The LSAP program's demand for treasuries was ending.
the oil price-linked demand from Gulf producers was also ending. The institution was approaching a normalization window with two major absorbers simultaneously departing. The following year, Simon Potter at the New York Fed documented that the demand was not merely ending, but reversing. In his September 16, 17, 2015 FOMC briefing, Potter recorded upward pressure stemming from sizable sales of treasuries by Chinese and other emerging market reserve managers intervening to support their currencies. And the supporting desk materials noted that Chinese sales of treasuries likely put significant upward pressure on yields. By mid-2017, the staff had moved from describing intervention as an emerging market phenomenon to documenting its absorption consequences for the US market itself. In a July 14, 2017 memo to the committee, board, and New York Fed staff wrote, "Foreign official investors on net have turned to foreign exchange rate intervention sales of US assets over this period, leaving US domestic investors to absorb essentially all of the recent net issuance in both treasury and agency debt. The flight to quality flows the institution had expected to support the market during stress were being offset by active intervention sales, and the burden of absorption had shifted onto domestic investors. The mechanism by which foreign demand shifts is specific. Seth Carpenter, then Deputy Director of the Division of Monetary Affairs, at the September 20, 2011 FOMC meeting, identified the supervisory channel. Some of these institutions are being urged by their supervisors to beef up their US dollar liquidity, and so they may be holding both more reserves and more treasury securities. Supervisory pressure is one driver. Currency intervention is another. When a foreign central bank defends its exchange rate against the dollar, it sells dollar reserves, which means selling treasuries. Reserve manager portfolio rebalancing is a third. Each driver operates on its own clock, responds to different pressures, and can reverse direction when conditions change. The composite demand is the sum of these separate flows, and it is pro-cyclical by construction. When the dollar is strong and US rates are high, the conditions the current program will produce, foreign central banks tend to sell to defend their currencies, not accumulate. The Federal Reserve's forecast record on this variable is uneven. In December 2015, staff projected that 10-year Treasury yields would reach approximately 4% by late 2017. The actual outcome was approximately 2.3%. The 170 basis point forecast error was caused in substantial part by a misreading of foreign demand persistence. The institution had forecast demand weakening faster than it did. The direction of that error was toward pessimism. A symmetric error in the opposite direction, forecasting demand as steadier than it will be, is what the current program's arithmetic implicitly assumes.
The pattern across this period is the gap between the specificity with which internal Federal Reserve deliberations tracked foreign demand mechanisms, Carpenter's 2011 supervisory channel, Dudley's 2014 demand reversal, Potter's 2015 documentation of active intervention sales, and the more aggregated language in which the same dynamics surfaced in public communications. The 2014 annual report on monetary policy itself recorded that the pace of foreign official purchases in the first three quarters of the year was the slowest in more than a decade, reflecting a significant slowdown in reserve accumulation by emerging market economies. The institution was tracking the shift. The roadmap's public framing of swap lines as stabilizing margin and of treasury issuance as coordinated absorption assumes a foreign demand variable that the institution's own record describes as already weakening a decade ago. The program holds three operational instruments that could respond to foreign retreat. Swap lines, deployed in 2008 and 2011 and 2020, have been crisis tools, deployed during stress and wound down during normalization. The archive records no precedent for swap lines operating as a standing absorption channel through multi-year balance sheet reduction. The FEMA repo facility, established after the 2019-2020 deliberations, provides foreign official institutions with access to dollar liquidity against Treasury collateral without requiring sales. Treasury issuance composition is the third. Each instrument has a precedent. None has the specific precedent of coordinated deployment against pro-cyclical foreign retreat at the scale a $2 trillion duration transfer implies. The instruments exist. Their coordinated deployment at program scale during a sustained reduction is not in the archive. A further dimension sits beneath the operational question. If the program's international instruments will require sustained coordination between Treasury and the Federal Reserve to deploy against foreign retreat, the institutional record on whether such coordination is compatible with monetary policy independence matters. The archive contains sustained friction on that question across four decades. The friction surfaces at the Reserve Bank level in sequential administrations. Jerry Jordan of the Cleveland Fed dissented at the February 3 to 4, 1994 FOMC meeting against the Treasury warehousing arrangement, on the recorded ground that providing funds to the Treasury using a warehousing arrangement was, in effect, a loan to the Treasury, and that direct financing of government operations by the central bank is inappropriate and could compromise the effective conduct of monetary policy. E. Gerald Corrigan of the New York Fed in 1990 raised parallel concerns about the perception of Fed-Treasury coordination eroding monetary independence. Jeffrey Lacker of the Richmond Fed, during the 2007 to 2011 crisis period, repeatedly, on the FOMC record and in subsequent interviews, characterized credit market interventions and swap line activity as functionally fiscal policy, conducted without the congressional appropriation that would normally accompany distributional credit decisions of that scale. These are not isolated voices. They are Reserve Bank presidents of three different eras identifying the same structural vulnerability: that Treasury-coordinated international operations at scale compromise the independence claim the Federal Reserve's doctrine rests on. The archive is not unified in opposition. It also contains the formal separability doctrine, the Federal Reserve's standing position articulated in successive chair statements through the 2010s and reiterated in Treasury-Fed policy frameworks, that the Treasury speaks for the US government on the dollar and exchange rate policy, while the Federal Reserve speaks on monetary policy. Both records coexist. The fracture is that the roadmap relies on the formal separability claim alone, and the institution's own Reserve Bank record suggests that the operational scope the program requires may reactivate the friction the formal claim does not address. What remains?
Four sections of archive comparison have been run. Three of them return operational fracture points. The floor did not move in the comparable case, and the institutional apparatus did not see it coming. The reforms the current floor depends on have been attempted five times across five decades and produced behavioral change in none. The Treasury-Fed coordination the rate cut commitment relies on has historically held for 2 to 4 years and was received by the Fed's own chair in retrospect as partially self-defeating in the operation most directly analogous to the current program. Each of these is a piece of the sequence the roadmap commits to. Each can be named, dated, and located in the archive. Each affects the timeline within which the program operates. The fourth section returns something different. The foreign absorber, whose stability the arithmetic implicitly assumes, is not an operational instrument the program holds. It is a structural condition the program inherits. The pro-cyclicality Carpenter named in 2011, the demand reversal Dudley named in 2014, the Chinese sales Potter documented in 2015, the absorption shift the staff memo recorded in 2017. These are not failures of an instrument the program could redesign.
They are the archive's record of what foreign holders do when the conditions the program is designed to produce arrive. The first three fractures are about whether the sequence can be executed on the timeline. The fourth is about whether the sequence's success depends on a condition the doctrine has not named. The pillar. The roadmap's arithmetic, written out in full, contains a step the doctrine does not address. The rate cut commitment requires long-end yields to fall. Long-end yields fall at the program's scale only if duration absorption holds. Duration absorption at the $2 trillion scale the program implies depends on foreign holders continuing to absorb at the lower yields the program is designed to produce. Foreign holders absorbing at lower yields requires a reason. The yield is the reason that is being reduced. What remains is the reason the program does not name. Foreign official holders hold treasuries for three reasons. The first is yield. The second is safety. The depth, liquidity, and credit quality of the US Treasury market relative to alternatives. The third is structural function. The role of dollar reserves in trade settlement, currency intervention, banking system dollar liquidity, and the supervisory mandates Carpenter named in 2011. The roadmap's interest rate commitment removes the first reason on the official holder's own terms. The second reason is unchanged by the program. The third reason is what holds the absorption capacity the arithmetic depends on. The third reason is the dollar's reserve currency status. The Federal Reserve's archive on this point is direct. Henry Wallach, in 1983, recorded the institutional understanding in a single sentence. From the Henry Wallach, "There's some limit to the volume of government bonds that the public is willing to hold, and that therefore, necessarily, a continuing deficit leads to monetization." Wallach was naming the constraint that reserve status displaces. A government whose currency is not the global reserve faces the limit Wallach described, a public willingness to absorb that erodes when yields stop compensating for risk. A government whose currency is the global reserve faces a softer version of the same constraint, with the softening provided by structural demand that does not require yield to motivate it. Reserve status is what permits the willingness to extend further than yield alone would justify. The roadmap's success condition reduces, after all the operational layers are stripped, to the proposition that this softening will hold through the execution window without an instrument deployed to maintain it.
The doctrine, traced through the chairmanship's named axes, articulates a specific architecture. The pillars maps four operational commitments in Warsh's confirmation testimony. Recognize AI as a phase transition supply shock requiring revised potential output and natural rate models. Repair. Overhaul of the 2020 framework of measurement, trimmed mean and median measures over core PCE, and of forward guidance practice. Reclaim. Narrow the mandate by retreating from climate, DEI, and regional bank advocacy outside monetary policy. Retreat. Withdraw the balance sheet from the long-dated Treasury and agency MBS positions. Warsh names fiscal policy in disguise. The axis maps the two-register architecture that frames those four pillars. Operational independence, narrow on monetary policy proper, explicit coordination with the administration on non-monetary matters, stewardship of public monies, bank regulatory and supervisory policy, areas affecting international finance. None of these commitments addresses the external demand condition that the rate cut commitment, examined to its arithmetic floor, depends on. The doctrine names four pillars and a two-register architecture. The arithmetic depends on a pillar the architecture does not name. The institution's own record on the unnamed pillar is direct. Timothy Geithner, then vice chairman of the FOMC and president of the New York Fed, named the structural condition explicitly at the October 28, 2009, 2008 meeting, where the committee was approving the swap line extensions to Brazil, Mexico, Korea, and Singapore. From the Timothy Geithner,
The privilege of being the reserve currency of the world comes with some burdens. Geithner was naming the condition the program now inherits without specifying. Reserve currency status is a privilege. The privilege carries operational burdens. The burdens fall on the institution that issues the currency. The 2008 swap line architecture was an instance of the institution discharging one of those burdens, providing dollar liquidity globally to keep foreign holders of dollar assets from being forced into liquidation, which is to say, defending the absorption capacity that reserve status depends on. The roadmap published by the chairmanship's named axis commits to using swap lines as crisis tools and to coordinating with Treasury on dollar funding. But the doctrine does not articulate that these instruments are how reserve status is maintained. The 2008 institutional understanding was that the Fed acts as international lender of last resort because the privilege requires it. The current program treats the privilege as a property the program inherits without specifying the operations that maintain it. Geithner's sentence on the 2008 record is the authoritative statement of what the doctrine omits. The institutional understanding extends across the eras the doctrine inherits from. At the October 6, 1979 FOMC meeting, where Volcker proposed the operating procedure shift, Governor Philip Caldwell named the operative risk inaction would create. From the Philip Caldwell: "If we don't put out something fully credible, we face a potential blow-up via a speculative move in the metals commodities that spreads out from there. In effect, a flight from dollars." Caldwell was naming what reserve status meant in operational terms. That the willingness to hold dollars is not a property the institution can take as given, that it can break down, that the breakdown shows up first in the metals and exchange markets, and then propagates. The 1979 program ultimately stabilized that willingness through monetary discipline of an extreme kind, a domestic policy lever the doctrine could pull. The current program does not contain a comparable lever. The discipline that maintained the willingness in 1979 is not in the four commitments the chairmanship's named axis articulates.
The institutional engagement continued through the 1990s. Governor Lawrence Lindsay delivered remarks titled "The Future of the Dollar as an International Currency" to the Conference on Monetary Arrangements in the Americas after NAFTA in Mexico City on May 25, 1994. An institutional intervention, on the record at Fraser, addressing the conditions under which the dollar's international role would persist or erode. Volek's 1974 description of the recycling inflow channel, the 1979 second oil shock, and 2006-2008 petrodollar surge that extended that recycling inflow tradition. The 2015-2016 China Foreign Exchange Reserve drawdown, and the March 2020 episode that tested the absorption architecture in the opposite direction. Across each episode, the institutional record traced what the doctrine does not name: that reserve status is the privilege which permits the absorption capacity, that the privilege is conditional, and that the conditions on which it depends, including the operational burdens Geithner named in 2008 and the credibility discipline Caldwell named in 1979, are not produced as a derivative of domestic credibility alone. The four pillars and the two-register architecture the named axis articulated do not contain the instrument the institution's own record names as the one reserve status depends on. The choices. The commitment is public. The rate cut rhetoric is locked in. The quarterly refunding statements are scheduled, the first on May 7th, the next on August 5th. The FOMC meetings are scheduled. The Administrative Procedure Act clock runs independently of the political clock, and the political clock runs independently of the balance sheet clock. The choices remaining to the program are operational choices within the sequence it has already committed to. Slow the runoff caps and the program stalls further from the stated target. Accelerate the caps and the floor binds sooner. Defer the active MBS sales and accept housing spread neutrality.
deploy them at scale, and accept mortgage rate drag the political authorization may not tolerate. Reopen the subordination doctrine the 2019 FOMC settled against. Retain the doctrine and concede that the rate cut commitment has to be delivered through the federal funds rate alone. The doors that remain open are narrower than the roadmap's public framing suggests, and each one narrows the others. The test. The coordination established the architecture. 4 seats, 5 failure points, 2 endpoints, a commitment stated under oath, and a rate cut promise attached to it. The test ran each piece of the architecture against the Federal Reserve's own documentary record of comparable episodes. The archive does not contradict the roadmap's diagnostics. The institution has understood each of the mechanisms the program deploys. The 2017-2019 committee knew the floor was uncertain. The 2024 Bowman knew stigma cannot be legislated away. The 2011 committee participants knew Treasury-Fed coordination at close proximity carries costs as well as benefits. The 2010-2017 committee knew foreign demand is pro-cyclical. The roadmap's diagnostics are legible in the archive. What the archive returns under examination is not 4 parallel fractures. It is 3 operational fractures and 1 structural condition. The floor, the reforms, and the coordination are pieces of the sequence the program holds instruments to manage. The arithmetic the rate cut commitment depends on, traced through duration absorption to the foreign holders the absorption requires, terminates at the dollar's reserve currency status. That status is the pillar the doctrine does not name. Volokh named it from inside the institution in 1983. There is a limit to the volume of government bonds the public is willing to hold, and reserve currency status is what determines how soft that limit is for a sovereign whose currency is the global reserve. The doctrine maps the 4 pillars its named axis articulated. The 5th pillar, the one the program's arithmetic treats as exogenous, and the one without which the rate cut commitment cannot be delivered through the channels the roadmap names, sits in the archive without a doctrinal companion. The program is a stress test of dollar hegemony, conducted by an axis that does not name it as a variable. The instruments the program holds, passive runoff, active MBS sales, regulatory reform, treasury composition coordination, swap lines deployed as crisis tools, operate on the first 3 fractures. The 4th, the structural condition, is not addressed by the operational architecture. It is addressed, if at all, by whatever the institution does to maintain reserve status while the program executes, and the doctrine does not specify what that is. The observables are scheduled. The first quarterly refunding statement arrives in 12 days. The first post-confirmation inflation prints arrive 6 weeks after the confirmation vote. The first liquidity coverage ratio reproposal publication is estimated for the second or third quarter. The reserve's approach to the $2.5 trillion early warning threshold arrives around month 6 of the program. The $2.3 trillion actionable stress threshold arrives around month 12. The behavioral change test on Bowman's reforms cannot return before 2028. The program will run continuously across all of these observables. The archive has returned what it has returned. The doctrine, examined against its own arithmetic, has 4 pillars and depends on 5. The 5th was visible in the archive long before the doctrine was articulated, and the chairmanship's program will be the first sustained operation conducted in its name without it on the doctrine's list. This has been the Monetary Blog from the FOMC Insight Engine at causalityineconomics.com.